Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Don sitting in the host chair today, using the virtual power of the internet to connect to one of our patrons and a listener and now a guest. So Eric Rush, welcome to A Fork in Time.
Thank you, Don. It's really good to be here. I've been very excited about this podcast for a while.
Good, good. Eric, we actually mentioned you last week. We were just talking off podcast about the situation here in Texas with the winter storm and power and other stuff. So Alexis and I got a little bit off on our production schedule. So we've accelerated this conversation with you. And as we were just talking about, this episode will go out almost immediately after we record it and I can edit it, which is interesting because the last episode that we aired was a topical suggestion of yours, even though you weren't on the podcast. That was what if Queen Victoria had not been a carrier of the genetic trait that produces hemophilia in descendants. And so I think of this as part two of the back-to-back Eric special. So
good. Well, I'm glad. And I really enjoyed that podcast. I thought you and Alexis did a great job with both the history and honestly the genetics. I thought that was really well done.
Yeah, I appreciate the topic suggestion. Thank you for that. So I'm glad to have you here along for the ride today. And so without any further ado, just letting the listeners know, what we're going to be talking about today again is Eric's suggestion. It's going to focus on what I think is one of the major accomplishments of the 20th century in terms of medicine. I was born in 1968, so all of this preceded me. And you know, Eric, you're born about a decade later. So We were just talking off podcast about the fact that there were things that we never had to face in terms of childhood diseases or other diseases because of what had happened with medical science in the preceding, well, couple of hundred years, but particularly in the preceding decades right before my birth. And probably the most notable, talking about vaccines and vaccines that we also talked about, we're going to talk about this as we move through the episode here. Vaccines are very much on everyone's mind right now because of the global pandemic, is that a remarkable thing happened in the early 50s called a polio vaccine.
Yeah, and a truly remarkable invention, absolutely.
And it did alter and change the course of, I think, in my understanding as a layperson, you bring professional expertise. I'm going to let you explain to folks who you are and what your background is here in a second. But as a layperson, I bring the fact that, you know, it advanced against that particular disease, but it also advanced the concept of how we attack with vaccines, you know, situations in general where vaccines can make a difference. And so today, I think we're going to focus specifically on the polio vaccine, just introduce the topic. What would have happened if there had not been the advent of the Salk, and I guess, is it Sabin or Sabine?
Yes, Sabin, Albert Sabin.
Sabin's. Yeah. That's an interesting story, too, as I was doing the research, even getting into the competing concepts there was a little bit of a – somebody's going to make a movie about that one of these days, and it'll probably be a good one. But talking about that, but then also, again, our point of departure is going to be, what if that had not happened then, and what we'd be living in now. So Eric, I've teased this a couple of times. Go ahead and tell people a little bit more about who you are and what you bring to the table, particularly talking about this topic.
So I'm very interested in the intersection of kind of scientific exploration and history, because I think that science doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, science happens within a society. And so there are societal and political implications to that. And one of the reasons why I'm so interested in those things is because I'm a physician by training. So I trained in internal medicine, pediatrics, and then I subspecialized in clinical genetics. And that's what I do for work, is work as a clinical geneticist. And so I treat adults and children who have inherited diseases. And in my case, I specialize in inherited skeletal and connective tissue diseases. So this is kind of going back a little bit into my training. So I mentioned that I trained in pediatrics. And so I did practice, you know, general pediatrics for a short period of time. And one of the most important things that we do as pediatricians is to vaccinate our patients. As Don, as you very correctly said, you know, the vaccination program is one of the great inventions of the 20th century and is continuing to pay off in the 21st century with new concepts for vaccines and new ways of delivering vaccines. And so I think, we're recording this in the middle of a pandemic. So I think that this topic is appropriate, not just for the exploration of history, but for, you know, what it could mean for us for the future too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're going to take a quick break here, come back and talk a little bit, as we often do, about the historical what did to set the context, because that'll allow us to take the point of departure. And when we do, we'll come back exploring the possibility, which is a scary possibility, actually, of what if there had not been the development of a polio vaccine in the middle of the 20th century. We'll be right back.
This is Don.
And Alexis.
Taking just a quick break from the podcast to tell you about something new that you'll find at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Boy, we push that a lot, don't we, Lex?
Yeah.
So we've talked about the other things that are there, but this is something that is...
brand new.
Brand new. So what is the brand new thing, Lex?
We have merchandise now.
Merchandise? But we're a podcast. Why would we need merchandise?
Well, merchandise is a good way to tell people about the podcast.
So it's like promotional advertising for the podcast?
Yes.
So we're doing a little ad here about the fact that we now have things that will be an ad?
Basically, yes.
Okay, so it's a little bit of looking through the universal length of mirrors here. But we're excited about the fact that we've created a partnership or relationship with the site is called TeePublic. And what's cool about TeePublic is, you know, a lot of times when you do promotional materials, you have to pay like these setup fees, and you have to do a large number of whatever you're doing, a t-shirt, a mug, a cap, whatever it is. It just becomes, well, it involves money. And so we were looking for a way, and I became familiar with TeePublic as a result of another podcast using them. And so it's a way to do promotional items or logoed items really effectively. So Lex, what are some of the options that exist there?
We can get things like a t-shirt, a hoodie, a coffee mug. That's a big thing for me. So tons of different options.
Yeah, and right now what we have there is the primary logo that you're most familiar with through your podcatcher. It's the A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast logo with our split arrows. I call it the split arrows in my head. I don't know if that's a term that Alexis uses, but when I think about the logo, it's the split arrows. So it's that logo that you're familiar with, and you can get it on any of those items. So you can find the link there off of our website that will carry you over to the TeePublic site. By the way, at TeePublic, there's all kinds of designers who have their things there. So we're just taking advantage of their platform with our logo. And so they're the ones who will then print the shirt, make the shirt, make the mug, pillows. There's all kind, totes, cell phone case covers.
Yep.
Are actually one of the things. So lots of different things there. Right now it's just the one logo, although Alexis and I have been talking about some of the other things that we'll add, so we'll invite you to come back. But what we invite you to do is rep the show. And you can rep the show by getting some of the logoed items that are available there on TeePublic, and you can find the link to that through our site. Anything else you want to say about that, Lex?
Go buy something.
Go
tell
buy
people
something.
About the podcast.
Yeah, and we'd appreciate it. So appreciate you being a listener and joining, and we'll go back to the podcast now.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Thanks for sticking with us through the break, and thanks again to Eric Rush for joining us today as a guest contributor, and he's a listener and a patron. So as we talked about before we went to the break there, our point of departure, our historical what if today is going to be what if there had been no development of a polio vaccine. And the timing on this, Eric, really is, I think of it as the 50s. Is that really the right time place to put it in?
I would think so. The early 1950s. And there was a lot of steps that got us to the Salk vaccine. And, you know, some of these happened even really earlier than the 1950s. So a lot of the kind of the, we'll call this foundational research for the development of the Salk vaccine happened even as early as the 1930s, but definitely during the 1940s. And in terms of things like, how do you grow polio virus in a lab? You know, those are really important things to be able to do before you're going to have a vaccine. But I definitely think that kind of the crux of this point of departure is likely to be in the early 1950s. And this is when a lot of the trials were being conducted, and a lot of the concepts surrounding how the Salk vaccine was created kind of came into fruition. And so just so our listeners who may not be virologists, or maybe some of them are virologists, I don't know. but just so our listeners know, so the Salk vaccine is an inactivated polio vaccine, so which means that that you actually take live vaccine and then you kill it. And there's a lot of ways that you can kill bacteria and vaccines. Well, one way to do it is to heat them. Another way to do it is to treat them with chemicals. And this is what was done in the Salk vaccine is to treat those polio virus strains with formalin. And you know, we all, you know, formalin can be pretty toxic chemical, and so it kills a variety of tissues, and so it in this case it did work. And you know, so we kind of talk about the what did happen before we talk about the what could happen or what if. We can see that the formalin was an effective way to kill the virus. And so in the early 1950s, this was kind of 1952, 1953 era, then when the Salk was testing the vaccine, there was some good response. You know, it was about 90% effective against polio strains, and the safety looked good when it was done under controlled circumstances. And part of the kind of the what if could relate to an incident that happened in reality. So and I don't know, Don, if in your own research you came along something called the Cutter incident. I don't know if that.
Yeah, I was going to reference that, and the other thing I was just going to reference, just as a point of note, without going back into it, is I think it's also an interesting point of departure would have been, where would all of this have been had it not been for the fact that a sitting president of the United States had been stricken with as an adult, which was also a little bit unusual, had not been stricken with polio, because March of Dimes, the research efforts, all the things that go on with that, Franklin Roosevelt is driving that for personal reasons, but also for broader purposes as well. But if you don't have someone of that stature, that influence, you know, where Salk would not have been where he was in the early 50s had it not been for the fact that for 20 plus years, Roosevelt had been leading the charge to do something about this.
Absolutely. And I think you bring up an excellent point, Don. And I think you could even argue that what we now know is the March of Dimes, and what was actually founded as the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, and this was founded by FDR in 1938, and they raised millions of dollars for funding and funding for polio research, and really a lot of the foundational research that was done, you know, a lot of the type of basic research that paves the way for vaccine research, for direct vaccine research, was funded by this. And both Salk and Sabin were funded by the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. Even though that there, you know, there were some, you know, political issues that were going on there, that the Salk vaccine was preferred by that foundation. And that had, again, you know, political implications and implications in the way that the respective vaccines were adopted in the U.S. But suffice to say, it had FDR not started that entity, it would have stalled research by a number of years. You know, eventually there would have been other vaccines, but they may not have been created in the U.S. You know, for instance, the Pasteur Institute in France was also working on polio research. Well, this might have given them an edge if there wouldn't have been a National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, and so we might be thinking about a Pasteur Institute vaccine instead of a Salk or Sabin in a vaccine. So that would have been very interesting. And, you know, and just kind of a little background, there's actually some question whether FDR truly had polio.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there is some question about this. It's not that a person couldn't get contract polio at age 39, as he apparently did, or was thought to have done. There's actually some suggestion that it may be a kind of a different autoimmune disease that created his paralysis. There's a condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome, where people can actually have sort of ascending paralysis from kind of the bottom up. Most people with Guillain-Barré recover, but it can take a long period of time, and there are some people with Guillain-Barré that don't recover. So there's been some suggestion that it could be something totally different, not polio related. So what if the other kind of what if there is not just what if FDR didn't get sick? what if he had gotten sick and somebody had recognized this is something different? You know, this is not polio. This is something else. And then he, you know, maybe he wouldn't have been as motivated to start this because he, you know, he would have not attributed his own issues, he kind of linked them with infantile paralysis that was so important at the time. So there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, I was actually looking at that again during the research, thinking about, well, where's the best point? Well, I can think of five or six interesting exits off the freeway here that would have been points of departure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and one of them is even you know, we talked about what if the Salk vaccine had not been successful at all, and that was a real possibility. I mean, this was the kind of one of our first attempts to do an inactivated virus sort of a vaccine. And so it was not a foregone conclusion that it was going to be successful. So, you know, what if the trials had totally failed and we would have had to go back to the drawing board? That was a real possibility. The other possibility is what if the Salk vaccines had been completely pulled off the shelf in 1955? And so this is kind of getting to what you and I hinted at with the Qatar incident. And so basically what happened was in 1955, let me back up a little bit, Don. So after the IPV, the inactivated polio vaccine was approved, it was then farmed out to a group of pharmaceutical companies. So it wasn't the US government making it. It was the US government saying, okay, here are the ground rules. Here's what's approved. You know, go get it done. Well, Salk had a very detailed way of inactivating the vaccine. So it was a very detailed way to do this in the trials and you know, clinical trials in general. And I say this, I've been an investigator on clinical trials myself in the past. And you have an extremely strict framework when you're dealing with clinical trials. You know, it was less strict in the 50s than it is, you know, now, but it's still pretty strict. And that's a good thing. You know, you want all your research to be conducted in a way that is, you know, extremely structured, extremely ethical. You want all of this attended to very well. And so when it got out in the wild, what was given to these companies was a very condensed version of the protocol that Salk used. And so a couple of the labs, including Qatar Pharmaceuticals and another company called Wyeth, they actually had batches of the inactivated vaccine that they didn't kill all the virus. And so a number of people experienced paralysis after getting these doses in 1955. And they figured this out because people were actually getting paralysis in the arm that they were getting the injection. So they would get the injection and then they would lose movement in that arm and experience paralysis. And as far as we can tell, this issue probably caused about 40,000 cases of polio in wow. In 1955. At least 10 people died and 250 people were paralyzed because of this. So it was a big deal. And it was a real discussion, you know, with US regulatory entities as far as what do you do here? You know, do you do nothing, which doesn't seem like a good idea? Do you work with the companies to try to pull off very specific lots that we're concerned may not be up to par? Or do you just basically close the whole program and, you know, pull all the polio vaccines? And they kind of chose the middle ground, more or less. You know, they chose that middle ground and not to just pull all of the Salk vaccines, but they certainly could have made that choice. They could have made that choice, and that would have been a different point of departure in 1955, where you pull the Salk vaccine off, and then you don't have a Sabin vaccine yet to really replace it, and so you might have a period of time where the polio cases bump back up.
So yeah, and of course, this was coming off, I guess, in the early 50s, there had been an outbreak. There were these waves, and so a lot of what was happening there, from when I was reading the history, is in 52, I guess 53, up to like 55. New urgency was attached to moving this forward. Not that there hadn't been urgency before, but there were outbreaks, and
there were definitely an increased urgency there. You know, 35,000 cases in 1953.
Yeah,
and that was a big deal.
And of course, the other amazing thing to me there that I get fascinated by the science to the extent that I understand it. And I did a lot of chemistry through my education, but I avoided biology like the plague. The last time I had formal biology was in seventh grade, believe it or not, Eric. So I can follow the biology okay, but not as well as I can often follow the chemistry. But just reading through, like you were talking about how they inactivate the virus, essentially you leave the shell so that it triggers the antibodies without having the dangerous RNA that can replicate from inside the virus. You know, that's how you sort of, you know, make it less effective by deactivating it. But then also just really them even coming to an understanding of what was causing it. You know, as it turns out, it's it's attached to, I guess, the digestive system and fecal matter, and then getting back potentially into water supplies or other ways. And you know, things I realized, doesn't matter how well, this is not, yes, poor sanitary conditions can certainly lead to this being more common, but even when you're being careful, even when you're washing your hands, even when you're doing everything else, it's just the nature of what this is causes it to be what it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the things that we found out with polio that was not really known in the early parts of the 20th century, is that it actually replicates within the gut, within the intestines, and in many people, you know, and you could even draw some correlation to our current pandemic. And, you know, many people who in whom polio is infecting their gut, they may never really have any sort of neurologic complications for this. It was a minority of patients that had the neurologic infection and developed paralytic polio. But it was, even though it was a minority of those patients, it was still enough that it was a huge deal, and it was a public health issue. So, you know, kind of a little personal story. So when I was just out of training, as a very, you know, a newly minted assistant professor, I had a small office that was in what used to be a polio wing of the hospital that I worked at. And it was a very long, skinny office. Well, why would that be helpful? Well, to accommodate an iron lung. And, wow. and you could really see in all the way, everything with the whole architecture of that wing where which was then office space, no patients were there and hadn't been there in decades, but you could see where that was, where these were previously places where iron lungs, with patients inside the iron lungs used to reside. Wow. So kind of a little interesting history there.
And I guess a reminder every day, indirectly, and maybe not every day crossing the mind, but the reminder of, that used to be what was necessary for treatment. Or, I mean, you know, just, I remember one of the things I saw, I guess it was a March of Dimes ball or something like that, where they were depositing like the proceeds into an iron lung, which was sort of symbolic, and it was pretty powerful. So now, picking up on the point of departure, I think we've done a good job of setting the stage here. So we're going to assume, I'll let you decide, which assumption are we going to make about what did not happen and the implication of that?
I think probably the cleanest way to do this is, let's just assume that the test of the Salk vaccine in the early 50s is just a bust for whatever reason. Okay. It doesn't work. Maybe we can't get reliable inactivation. And so we risk infecting people inadvertently. And so the Salk vaccine is shelved. So there's no Salk vaccine. And so this is a significant point of departure and an increased sense of urgency, because in what did happen, you know, polio cases went from 35,000 cases in 1953 to 5,600 in 1957. And by 1963, if memory serves, less than 100. And so, you know, so it was a big deal. So we're waiting on this. And so there's a couple of ways that this could go, in my opinion. And so you've got the Sabin vaccine that is being tested. And in what did happen in our timeline, the Sabin vaccine was mostly tested outside of the US, because the March of Dimes had a stated preference for the Salk vaccine. And so Sabin went outside the US, you know, in some cases pretty close by, like Mexico, but in some cases not so close by, like the Soviet Union. And so there was some real political ramifications to this. You know, again, this is in the middle
that's the heart of the Cold War. Yeah,
middle of the Cold War. And Sabin actually had permission in the mid-50s to go to Leningrad to collaborate with a Soviet scientist to work on their oral version of the polio vaccine. So a different philosophy for this instead of inactivating the virus, what you do is you attenuate it. And so once a virus is passed through usually a non-human cell line many, many, many times, and typically they'll do this at a lower temperature. And what it does is it induces mutations within the virus. And you can induce mutations in a way. And the hope is, and what we actually see in practice is that you do this in a way that is that you reduce the virulence of the virus in question, and to the point where it no longer, you know, promotes any real symptoms at all. And you do this orally because, as we said before, you know, poliovirus likes to replicate in the gut. And so if it likes to replicate in the gut, well, let it replicate in the gut. And it actually gives very good immunity to do it that way. And in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, it's safe. Now, there's a couple of ways that the U.S. could have reacted to this at this point. You know, at this point, there's no Salk vaccine, and so there's a little more urgency. Maybe we put our political ramifications aside for a little bit and say, okay, let's, you know, Dr. Sabin, who was practicing in Ohio, if memory serves, at the time. So he was here in the U.S. Actually practicing, but just he was doing his clinical trials outside of the U.S., including in the Eastern Bloc. And so, you know, we might put our political ramifications aside and say, well, let's bring this trial back in the U.S. And so we may actually have a Sabin vaccine in the U.S. by the late 1950s. But I still think that there would have been a lot of mistrust, and indeed in our current actual timeline, what happened is there was a lot of mistrust of the results of the Sabin trials, because Western scientists did not trust Soviet scientists, and really vice versa, but they did not trust it. And so I think that there's the additional possibility there could have even been a second point of departure, that the mistrust of the, you know, the communist bloc could have been such that it actually would have been later. You know, you could have had a further delay instead of having the Sabin vaccine approved in 1961, like it actually was. You know, you could have easily seen even just a few years of delay. And that would have had huge ramifications if it would have been until, you know, 1965, 1966, been before that oral polio vaccine was approved. That, you know, you could have had a longer period of time where polio was endemic in the U.S. As it is now, the last case of polio of actual polio infection in the U.S. was in 1979,
which I think you indicate is a year relevant to you, at least in some
way.
Yeah,
right? So I was born in 1979, and it doesn't seem like it's that long ago, although every year it seems like it's a little further ago. And
my brain started going to lots of different places there as we were talking about the possibilities, because one of the things I noted in doing some of the historical research were how social behavior for parents was being altered there in the early 50s, not knowing what I guess it's fair to say that, you know, I think there was obviously an understanding of what the cause was. So, okay, now we have a little bit better understanding of the cause, but still with no vaccine, which essentially served as the cure, right, by being the vaccine, is that, you know, people weren't letting their kids go to swimming pool. I mean, just the impact on society in general. So one of the things that I was thinking through, if you don't have it come along then, and that takes root over a number of years or a decade or two, just how it alters social interactions, school interactions, and maybe it's only at a minor level, but particularly aware of that because of what we've gone through in the last year with the pandemic, about how it's altered the way society works. Maybe for ways that we'll think are better, and it'll just be different, good and bad. It'll just be different. I think you would have had some of that continuing to move forward in the 50s and 60s in such a way that the way that, for example, we think of the way that kids interact in school or public swimming pools or, you know, who knows what number of things we haven't thought through what all the implications are, but the ripples are probably small, but the ripples can also be big.
Absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head with the public swimming pools. I think you had these outbreaks in the early 1950s, and, you know, my parents who were, you know, born in the, well, one born in the late 40s, one born in 1950, relate stories when they were really little about the municipal pools being closed for the summer because of polio outbreaks. And this is, you know, this would have been mid 50s when they were young children. I think if you have a longer period of time where polio is endemic in the U.S. at those high rates, so, like, you know, let's assume that there are, you know, multiple years of, you know, 25,000 plus cases in the U.S., then I think not only do you have your pools being closed temporarily, I think you have pools being shut down. And I think, the places where we see pools that are used in common, like, hotels and places like that, I think maybe those go away too. If it's not, if it's 1968 before we really start getting a significant decrease in the polio cases, because it takes a few years, and we saw this in our timeline too, you had the institution of the vaccine, and it took 3 or 4 years before we really saw huge decreases in numbers. So I think you do see those societal changes, and much like a lot of the societal changes that we're seeing with our current pandemic are probably going to be permanent. One of the ways that it's probably going to be permanent is Zoom meetings, which is exactly how we're talking here today. And I think these are not going away.
Yeah, and again, just carrying it forward, which is where I think we talked about this off podcast, is part of the reason I like doing alternate history is what how does it inform what we know about the past, and how does it inform maybe about things that we know today? Is that, for example, I believe that the concept of business office space globally, particularly in the United States, is never going to be the same after this. The concept of, there was already tremendous amount of remote work and work from home that was already something that had taken a hold in society. It hasn't just taken a hold, it's become the norm now in society, and how that changes things. And so this small little thing you can't even see without a microscope called a virus, right, is having this massive impact on our society as a whole. And so, I'm thinking back to polio, I think back to other things you were talking about. If this was actually here, we talk about chickenpox as being another thing that there's now a vaccine for. I suffered from chickenpox as a child. My daughter actually, when she caught chickenpox, she was staying with my parents at the time, or we mm-hmm. took her up to stay with my parents at the time. So we didn't have to thankfully deal directly with the parental control of a young child with chickenpox, because that's not a fun thing to do. There's a whole generation now of parents who, if they had to encounter that, wouldn't even know that was the norm. In fact, I know in the past it used to be the norm of, okay, I'm going to expose my child now because I want to get this done and over with, kind of thing, versus, what would a parent do today? You talk about the example you were giving, because it had pretty much been eradicated when you were in practice. It was like, that might be chicken pox. I'm at least open. Oh, okay. That's what it is. You've got two little dots on your forehead. You've got chicken pox.
Right. Absolutely. And I had chicken pox in, it must've been 1988. And so I had it at a time when it was probably the least likely to cause a really severe disease, because sometimes people get really, really sick with chicken pox, not very frequently, but sometimes people will even get and can even get encephalitis from it, can get an inflammation of the brain that happens from chicken pox. It tends to happen more at extremes of age. If you get it really, really young or really, really older, an adult chicken pox is no picnic for people to get it. And shingles, not fun.
I've had that as well. So I can speak to personal experience, not fun at all.
So I actually had a friend who had chicken pox. And this was right after the 4th of July in 1988. And I had a friend who had chicken pox, and I distinctly remember my mom was like, no, bring him over. So she helped take care of him when he was sick, but knowing that chicken pox, which is quite contagious, would almost invariably infect myself and my sister, and it did. So we both got chicken pox, and fortunately both had some pretty what I would consider to be pretty typical cases of chicken pox. I felt rotten for a week and super itchy and things like that, but fortunately it came out of it no worse for the wear. A couple of little pox scars I had, but no worse for the wear. But that was common in the late 80s, mid 80s, to you wanted to get your pox party out of the way. Yeah. Especially if you were lucky enough to do it in the summer and your kids didn't have to miss school.
Right. Absolutely. So is it a fair thing for me, from my understanding of sort of the medical history here, that certainly the concept of vaccines go back, I guess, back to the common story there is how the discovery of how cowpox could be used to offset the smallpox, which is far more serious and deadly. Right. See any past historical reference between Native Americans and those coming from Europe for how smallpox altered history. No doubt about that whatsoever.
No doubt.
But is it a fair thing? Do I have the right understanding, I guess, is my question here, that the success of what was done with polio in the early 50s was a springboard for a lot of what followed after that in terms of, okay, we accomplished the vaccine for that. What else can we accomplish an effective vaccine for?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think once we figured out the, with kind of both concepts, with both a kind of like a live attenuated or a virus or the kind of what we would do for the oral polio virus and then the inactivated virus, both of those concepts proved to be really important. And so, you know, and so live attenuated viruses are used in some other cases too. So, you know, for instance, like measles. The measles virus or the measles vaccine that's a live attenuated or and the influenza vaccine that we use now is an inactivated form of this. And so we've used those lessons to create a number of different vaccines. And so, you know, with even pretty quickly after the polio vaccine, we started working on things like measles, mumps, rubella, and improving certain other vaccines. And so we'd had a pertussis vaccine for a long time. So that's the, and diphtheria vaccine. But those, both of those had been improved on with modern technology. And so now, you know, so I, you know, we, if we look at our vaccine books from when you and I grew up, Don, you know, it's a fairly short list of things that we got immunized against. And so, I don't know, you might be just old enough to have been vaccinated for smallpox. I don't know. You might be not, you might be a little too young for that, but I wasn't vaccinated for smallpox because there were, at the time there wasn't any point.
Right, there was no need for it. Yeah, I actually do have that. Is that the one that actually has the little,
yep, you've got the little scar on your arm?
I've got the little scar. Yeah, I can.
Yeah.
But and again, we're only separated in age by about 10 years. And so right. that shows how in a fairly short period of time, things can change in such a way that, again, why do the vaccine? We've eradicated the disease, right? For all intents and purposes at that point.
Absolutely. And that's the right time to, you know, to stop vaccinating for something is when you've completely eradicated it. And so at the, and I think if memory serves, it was 1972 that we totally phased out the smallpox vaccine.
So I was born just in time to get the little scar on my arm. Yeah.
And so by the time I came along in 1979, there was no smallpox around, not in the U.S. and it was declared officially eradicated, you know, shortly after that. And so now, you know, smallpox only exists in, you know, in specimens in laboratories.
Yeah.
You know, there is no smallpox running around, thankfully, and hopefully the same would be true for polio.
Yeah. So if we divert there again, the alternate history path here, if we divert that in the early 50s. And so there's three things that go on there. I mean, one of the pictures that I came across, it probably ended up being the picture that sort of, for those that go to the website and see what we post for when an episode gets posted, it's probably going to be a picture of Elvis getting vaccinated, because yeah. one of the ways of, you know, proving that this was safe and effective and all the other things was, you know, we saw this with the COVID vaccines, you know, the public vaccinations were a way of people that had influence of various types saying, I'm doing this, it's safe to do this, it makes sense to do this, all the things that go with that. So do you think there would have been, especially after the Cutter incident, maybe that still happens or something like that?
Yeah.
And there was also a vaccine issue in the 70s, and I can't remember what it was around. Maybe was that around, Legionnaires' disease, perhaps, or something in the, there was something in the 70s where there was something where there was an adverse outcome to a series of vaccination. I can't remember what it was now. I'll try to find
that
something.
Might have been that one escapes me, Don. I don't, that might okay. be Legionnaires' disease, because that's something that had popped up, you know, beforehand, you know, that yeah. popped up, you know, fairly recently before that.
But again, multiple instances of where the good thing vaccine, because of an incident that happened, gets labeled with a negative spin in terms of its, either its efficiency or more importantly, its safety. You take the vaccine, you're going to get the thing you're trying to prevent versus preventing right. the thing that you don't want to get.
And we're very strict about that. And so there, you know, the history of vaccines in the U.S. has really been one of remarkable safety. And in those cases where there have been kind of rare concerns about it, those vaccines have been taken off the market. So there was one of the cases that I can think of is in around the year 2000. There was a vaccine for an infection called rotavirus, and you know rotavirus is a very common reason why very small children get gastroenteritis. And in, you know, most of the time, everybody, you know, does okay with it. It's just a lot of diaper changes for these little kids. But sometimes kids get really dehydrated and can get really, really sick. And so there was a vaccine that was created. And what was found out is that this vaccine actually increased the risk of a condition called intussusception, where the intestine kind of we'll call it like coils in on itself, if you will, or slides in on itself, and that can be a real problem that can sometimes need to be surgically corrected. So when it was discovered that there was a link there, it was taken off the market, because this was not a common occurrence. This was still a rare occurrence, but it was taken off the market, and because there is a need and a desire for vaccines to be so safe, to be released into the wild, so to speak. And so a subsequent vaccine for rotavirus was released a number of years later, and you know, kids are getting it now. All but my three kids were vaccinated for rotavirus as well, and this is and it's proven to be much safer. So the story of vaccines and the vaccines that are currently on the market now is actually a story of remarkable safety and efficacy.
Yeah, and that flows from the success, again tying back to what we focus on here, with, because we could go into, I'd love to go on and talk about the science, but that's not what we are here as a podcast. but how it ties back to the alternate history thing is there was confidence in, first of all, the severity of polio and the fear of polio. The thing I was talking about, the fear of polio, led to, when there was success against it, a recognition of this vaccine is a godsend kind of thing.
Right. Absolutely.
And so you had a real tangible watershed moment for parents and for just society in general of saying, yes, there might be some risk attached to this. We've had some bad incidents, but the overall collective good far outweighs the collective bad. So we believe in science. I mean, to me, that's the irony of where we stand now. And we'll talk a little about this, and I'm okay to go there, is that we came to say, you know, science did a good thing here and we should do more of this. That was the real timeline.
Yes.
If you have this scenario where it's delayed, or like you said, there's distrust because I don't want that Soviet vaccine going in my kids. You know, they're going to grow up to be communists.
Communists. Because
this is the secret vaccination program to change their political will. That's, in some ways, it seems sort of corny to even talk about that, but it's real, because the way that things are perceived is the way that reality tends to become. And so the perception there of vaccine good in the simplest sense in the mid-50s, if we delay that, or like you talked about, it comes from another source, that alters a lot of stuff. And again, the irony to me, and I'm happy for us to go there, which is why one of the reasons I wanted to do this episode, Eric, is, what is the learning of that we can apply to 2021, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Don. And I think that again, I think you kind of hit it on the head with the, we need to trust science. And I think in the 1950s, I think people felt like they had no choice but to trust science, because there was this huge upswell in the numbers of cases of polio. And they saw how effective the vaccine was, and they saw, you know, the decrease of, you know, 90% over the course of a few years. And I think that in some ways we're kind of the victims of our own success, is that, you know, that we don't see these illnesses anymore.
Right.
Or even the ones that we do occasionally see, we don't see with any sort of great frequency. And because we're not seeing them, you know, we're not seeing the devastating effects of the illness itself, then I think our perception of risk is different. And I think our perception of risk is we are overestimating in some cases the risk of vaccines, which is very, very low risk, against the risk of having the illness, which has been in many cases very high. And we talk about the rarity of some of these conditions. And, you know, polio is, you know, again, doesn't exist in the U.S. at this point. And we were very close to measles not existing in the U.S. at all a number of years ago. And now measles is back. It's still not common, but we see it. Why do we see it? It's because our vaccination rates for that have dropped below a certain level. And, you know, once you get vaccine rates drop below a certain level, you start to lose that herd immunity. Right. You start to lose the ability to stop viruses from and bacteria from transmitting between people. So if you've got 95-96% of people that are vaccinated against an illness, you're just not going to be able to get the virus transmit with any sort of efficiency, and any one-offs will burn themselves out. But if you're getting to 80%, 70% below that, you're going to have problems. You're going to have these outbreaks that happen, and unfortunately, you see kids get really sick when these things happen. And sick with illnesses that are entirely preventable, and that's a concern. And again, we've seen this with whooping cough. We've seen this with measles fairly recently. And the concern, and where this kind of comes full circle into our 2020 and 2021 timeframe, is what does this mean for those of us for coronavirus? What does this mean for getting our vaccinations for that? And I was very excited to get my vaccine. So as a healthcare provider, I was fortunate enough to be kind of in that first wave of people getting their vaccine. And so I got my first vaccine on the 30th of December and my second on the 20th of January. And it was worth it. It was worth it. I was excited to be able to do it. And not just to protect my myself, but to protect my patients and protect society, because in reality, I'm a healthy 41-year-old guy. There's a good chance I would be in that 98% that don't have a whole lot of struggle with COVID-19. That for me it would just be a regular old viral infection, and I would be okay. But I did it for the other people, the people that aren't well, or that are older, that are likely to have that sort of risk of having worsening infections, and the people that are more likely to not survive from COVID. And so that's why I did it. And it was worth it, even though that first vaccine was pretty easy. I had a sore arm afterwards, but that second vaccine was not so fun. I'm not going to lie. It wasn't so fun. For about 12 hours, I felt kind of rotten after getting that second vaccine. But again, totally worth it. I would do it again. I would do it every year if I needed to. And that's the thing. I think one of the stories of the polio vaccine and just the vaccine programs in general are how important it is for us as a society to stick together, and how we can protect one another by doing these very simple things. And this is one of those cases where we can really protect one another.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, you and I talked about it off podcast. I'm happy to say it here. We talked about a couple of other episodes. I work very hard to keep the podcast what I consider to be as politically neutral as possible, because when you talk about historical things, it's easy to go down those paths, particularly recent historical things. But this is one of those things that I have no problem saying that I believe in vaccines. I believe in science. I believe every effort is being made to make things as safe as they can be. Even said that was the case back with the Qatar incident too. Nobody wanted to have that happen. That's one of the risks that comes with this. But and like most things in life, you balance a risk and a reward, and the reward side here is so much larger than the risk side. And I'm just going to ask you, just off the cuff here, we didn't talk about this off podcast, Eric, but speculating on another what if. What if we had? I've heard herd immunity numbers here. Do you have to be at 65%, 75%, 80%? What is that magic threshold that sort of, becomes the way that logarithmic scales work, becomes the diminishing return really quick? It's interesting how that works. A little move there does a lot. But what would be the historical what if here if there ends up being a large enough contingent of the population who decides, for whatever reason, fear, there's so much stuff out there, it's tough for people in a socially distancing world. It's even more difficult to get information to move around in a way that's not influenced by the fact you're socially distanced, which is part of the problem. So jumping a little bit ahead, what is the historical what if of today? What if enough people don't choose to go down the vaccination path? In your opinion,
these diseases will come back. No, there is no question. Some diseases will take longer. Polio right now is only really endemic in three countries, in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria. Those are the only three countries where we see endemic polio. So it would probably take a little longer for polio to come back, but you would have a number of preventable conditions that would come back pretty quickly. You would start seeing more in the influenza. Almost certainly, you would start seeing measles come back pretty quickly if enough people would stop vaccinating. Measles is incredibly contagious. It's incredibly contagious. It can spread like wildfire through under immunized or non immunized communities. And so measles would come back, pertussis or whooping cough would come back almost unquestionably. You would start to see some other conditions that would come back. One of the until the 1980s, one condition that happened pretty frequently was meningitis, caused by a condition or caused by a bacteria called Haemophilus influenzae, which even though the name implies it, it doesn't actually cause influenza. They thought it did, which is how it got its name. But in little kids, it caused a really, really bad meningitis, and it left many kids neurologically devastated. It left many of them deaf. It was a really, really bad thing, and so those things would come back too. Invasive pneumococcus, so pneumonias and things like that would be more common. So all of this will come back if we don't immunize, and that's not a guess. That's a guarantee.
Yeah, history proves that out because we've seen it in the past.
Absolutely.
And I guess the other thing, the way that I sort of tie this together to how we launched off, this has been a little bit different episode, but again, I've enjoyed the way we've approached this episode, thinking back to, okay, polio in the 50s, COVID in the 2020s, is how society changed. The other thing we've already talked about, but the other thing that immediately strikes me there as being important is if polio had not been eradicated through an aggressive vaccine program and a willingness by the public to go through that, I presume like any other situation, it would have mutated over time, correct?
It probably would have. There are different strains of polio. There are three kind of main strains of polio, and there's little subtypes even within that. So that's one of the things that we do see when viruses are kind of left to spread unchecked, there are just more replication events that happen, and any more replication events equals more chance for mutations. And so, mutations by themselves are kind of random events. And so we can kind of speculate on what would happen if polio were allowed to continue to replicate unchecked. It may be similar to what we have seen with COVID, is that we have some mutant strains of COVID that are at the very least of increased likely to cause contagion. So, there's a value that epidemiologists use to describe the number of people a person is likely to infect, and that's a value called the R0 or R0. And for kind of the wild type strain of COVID, the original ones that were isolated, it seemed to be about one by the time we kind of got everything in lockdown. The new strains seem to be more like 1.5 to 1.7. So said another way, they're 50 to 70% more contagious than the wild type strain.
And when you expand that out,
yeah,
there's exponential components to what happens there. It's not just it's how infection works. It's not just that I can infect maybe twice as many people, but the people that are infected can infect twice as many people, and so
absolutely.
On and so
yep.
on.
And so, one person becomes 10 people, becomes 1,000, becomes 1,000,000, and this can happen pretty quickly in a lot of cases. So
I sometimes say I'll do this and forget to do it in the show notes. I'll look for it and find it. There was an interesting thing that YouTube browsing last week found, which was they used mouse traps and ping pong balls to show the concept of herd immunity. And it's just worth watching because you're seeing that first of all, they tried it with 1,000 mouse traps and never could get it to work without accidentally setting them off. So they had to go to 500. But to see 500 mouse traps go off in super slow motion,
that's pretty
just
impressive.
For that alone, you need to go and look at the video. But there's also a good understanding there about why you know, the concepts of why vaccinations work and why it explains, yes, you can still get small outbreaks, but nothing like you would have had before.
Nothing like you would have had. And so the hope is at this point, you know, it would be great for us to get to 85 to 90% vaccination rate for COVID. Yeah. That would be great to get to 85 to 90%. In reality, you know, I think we'll probably be lucky to get to 70 to 75%, but, you know, and some of this is still, you know, is mistrust and I don't lay the blame at the feet of people with the mistrust. You know, that's number one, unproductive. And, you know, number two, it's not appropriate. I think that we as medical professionals or scientific establishment don't do a good job of reaching out to communities to explain. And I think this is especially true for, you know, marginalized communities, you know, historically marginalized communities. I don't think we do a good job at all of advocating for them. And we should, we have to. And I think that in many cases, they have no reason to trust us. And so I think that's one problem. But then the people I do fault are the people that are spreading deliberate misinformation. And unfortunately, that's, you know, again, you know, you and I agree that we like the fact that this podcast is fairly apolitical. But I think, you know, one of the things that I think we also can agree on is that we should be dealing with facts. We should be dealing with science. And
even when you're dealing with speculation. Things that are reasonable in terms of speculation.
Things that are reasonable, yeah. And I think that in this case, I think we it's important to be dealing, to be working with the same set of facts, and to not spread, you know, deliberate disinformation. So those people I do fault that are actively spreading disinformation.
Yeah, I agree. Is there anything about the polio thing that we missed? Do you think we should have hit? To be loyal to what launched us down this path, which is good.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things that I would also say is I think that you probably would see less of kind of, you know, vaccine mistrust if this was a later adoption. You know, I think, you know, again, you know, I'm kind of old for the older generation of people who have small kids. So my youngest is 5, my oldest is 11. And so that, you know, so I have children that are actively still getting vaccines, but, you know, I find that a lot of the younger parents that are, you know, that have younger kids, that these may be young parents that are still in their 20s, they never had any of these conditions. And so they don't see it the same way we did. But I think if you had a scenario where, you know, you're still seeing endemic polio in the US until, you know, the 1980s, maybe even 1990 is as late as if you really kind of delay the rollout of the Sabin vaccine, I think you would probably see more, maybe a more accurate perception of risk. And I think you might have fewer of, you know, we'll call them vaccine skeptics out there. And so that might be less of an issue. That, again, speculation, but I think that could be the case. Both my parents, and I don't know about your parents, Don, you know, both my parents had, you know, measles and rubella, and my mom had mumps and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And so, you know, they were very, very on time with getting, you know, getting all of my vaccines when I was a kid. So it was never a discussion.
That was very much my case. My biography is being, an only adopted child of parents that were 38 and 35 respectively when they adopted me. So my parents were both born in the early 30s. And so they had that, all of this, you know, even in their young adult lives, you know, the period of time we're talking about there in the 50s is when they were in their 20s. And so, you know, obviously if there was something that their child who came along 15 years later could take that would avoid that, as you well pointed out, they were going to do that. That was not even going to be a question for them. Right. Right. And I think you make a point there. The irony being that if it seems odd that a delay in vaccine, you know, delay in the development of that particular vaccine and other vaccines from the 50s into the 60s and the 70s, on the one hand, the one path of the what if there would have been a lot more bad things happening in the 50s and 60s, but as you well point out, it may actually have a positive impact on where we stand today, just because the optics, we would be moving the optic of the relative time frame back back and forth a little bit there. It's like in my head, I've got this image of a slider bar that you're moving there. You know, all it takes is like a generation and a half removed from the threat that's probably going to set in. Well, we don't have to worry about that anymore.
We don't have to worry about this anymore. And you also wonder if this would accelerate kind of our current efforts for polio eradication. And so there, 'cause there are programs for that. So the World Health Organization, you know, one of their focuses is on polio eradication. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation focuses on you know, vaccination programs worldwide. And so, you know, you do wonder if there was endemic polio in the U.S. until, let's just say, the 1980s, would there be a kind of a renewed zeal for these sort of polio eradication programs? Because you had, you know, those of us who grew up in the 70s and 80s, you know, maybe knew people that suffered from polio, you know, we would be maybe even more motivated to, you know, to embark on those sort of efforts. And, you know, so even though you would have had a later adoption of these vaccine programs, would you also then have such an interest in polio eradication that we could see polio eradication? Because it's, in my opinion, there really are not technical barriers to us eradicating polio. These are, you know, there are financial barriers, there are, you know, there are sociologic barriers, political barriers, but not technical ones. And so, you know, I think you could even see a really intense program, you know, and maybe you do see polio, you know, eradicated, you know, in, you know, 2015, you know, ish, you know, that's highly speculative, but it's not impossible.
Right.
You know, that again, very much like how we approach the smallpox issue.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that. Eric, I've really enjoyed the visit today and having you on as a guest. And
likewise, Don, this has been a lot of fun.
I'm hopeful that we can do it again. And we may even do it on a non-medical topic, because I know you have some interest there as well. So we'd love to have you there. Eric, again, thanks for joining us. And once again, we're closing out the episode here on A Fork in Time. And we'd like to thank our listeners for just giving us the greatest gift we think that they can give us, which is their time. Even if you're doing something else while you're listening to the podcast, you're at least giving us part of your attention. And so we value that. We encourage you to visit the website at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. You'll be able to find Eric's biography there to learn a little bit more about him as well. And also our back catalog and everything else that we always talk about, social media, sharing, Patreon, all the fun stuff that goes with what we normally close out a show with. But it's actually one of the, Alexis and I were talking over the last couple of weeks, so we've mentioned this a number of times. One of the things we've enjoyed about this journey of starting this podcast and having no clue where it was going to go was we've met some very nice people along the way. And if nothing else comes from this ever, the fact that I now have had a chance to talk for an hour with Eric Rush is a good thing. That's made my life better, and we feel that way just about things in general. So we hope that if we bring encouragement, we hope we bring a little bit of education, and hopefully bring a little bit of fun. So this is Don on Eric's behalf, and Alexis isn't here, but she requires me to sign off on her behalf as well. So we'll do that as well. And of course, our reminder always is, if you happen upon that fork in time along the way, our suggestion is, hey, Take it.
All right. Thank you, Don.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Learn more about the podcast at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Join us next time.